The CDC says blood pressure is out of control for too many Americans. Are you one of them? Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September 10th. It is so nice to be back. Thanks to Rob Ferret and Jean Purcell for filling in for me last week while I was out coughing away and dealing with a bout of pneumonia. I think I beat it. At least I feel better. And I'm looking forward to talking about a different health condition this hour. This one I don't have. High blood pressure. And I hope to find out how to keep it that way. And we will welcome your questions and concerns about preventing and treating high blood pressure following a new report from the CDC that says nearly half of 67 million Americans with high blood pressure are not effectively treating their condition and face a high risk of a heart attack or stroke. If you have a question, 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor and Associate Dean of Public Health at UW-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start with a little blood pressure 101. What is high blood pressure?
Well, we all need pressure in our arteries to pump the blood throughout the system, and that can be measured typically through a blood pressure cuff in the arm, and you use millimeters of mercury. And so there's a high number, which is really the force of the heart as it first pumps the blood, and that's called systolic blood pressure. And then there's a lower number, which is diastolic. It's the pressure at the rebound. And typically, a person might have a blood pressure of 120 over 80. It could be lower or higher. Lower blood pressure, if it gets real low, sometimes you have trouble with dizziness and fainting spells if you stand up quickly. and higher causes problems with blood vessels in the brain. You increase your risk of stroke, or the heart is working too hard, and you increase your chance of hypertensive heart disease. When it gets above 140 over 90, for example, we call that mild hypertension, and over 160 over 100, we call that moderate or severe. And there's significant evidence, many decades of research, showing that treatment of moderate or greater high blood pressure leads to lower risk of stroke and lower risk of heart disease.
Mm-hmm. And if your blood pressure is, say, 120 over 80, is that normal blood pressure?
I'd say that's normal blood pressure. There's a new category called borderline hypertension, which is in the above 120, sort of in the 120 to 140 range for systolic, and in the 80 to 90 range for diastolic. But 120 over 80 is in general the sort of the target rate that many people look for your blood pressure. There's variability from person to person, from time of day, even whether the person who's taking your blood pressure is wearing a white coat or not. It's called white coat hypertension. Some people get nervous and find that when a physician or healthcare provider comes into the room to take the blood pressure, it goes up slightly. And so there are a lot of things that can vary the blood pressure, but the most important thing is to know what your numbers are and know what they are over a long period of time.
So how widespread is the problem of high blood pressure?
Well, in this country, it is quite widespread. The CDC report that was just released last week shows that about 70 million people in this country have high blood pressure. That's been fairly constant over the past 10 or 20 years. It does increase as people have risk factors. Obesity turns out to be one of the most important risk factors for hypertension. So along with the obesity epidemic, we've then seen an epidemic of diseases related to obesity, like hypertension.
What are some other risk factors for high blood pressure?
Well, one's family history is important. If a parent has had high blood pressure, the child is more likely to have high blood pressure. Of course, that's not modifiable. People are interested in those things that they can change that might reduce their risk. And it turns out that the Western lifestyle that we've all come to become used to, is a risk factor. So diets high in sodium increase the risk of high blood pressure. And it's not just sodium in the added by table salt, but it's sodium in the food. And we really don't really realize how much sodium there is in foods that we eat when that are prepared outside of the home.
And the consequences of high blood pressure are primarily a higher risk of heart attack and stroke.
Yes, there are. It really affects the small vessels throughout the body. So you do see primarily stroke and heart disease, but it can also cause retinal problems, blindness, problem seeing. It can affect the kidneys, and those vessels are extremely important to regulate, it turns out, not only our blood pressure, but production of urine. And people with uncontrolled high blood pressure can have kidney failure. So it clearly is an incredibly important risk factor for major cardiovascular disease, renal disease, and all sorts of problems. So it's been almost 50 years since the studies showed that people who have high blood pressure benefit from treatment.
We'll talk more about that treatment in just a moment. We are talking with Dr. Patrick Remington, a professor and associate dean of public health at UW-Madison, about this new report from the CDC released last week that says nearly half of Americans with high blood pressure are not effectively treating it. So do you have high blood pressure? Is it under control? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. It's going to be a sunny, mild day today with highs in the mid to upper 70s. Clear tonight with lows in the 50s and a sunny, warm day tomorrow with highs in the low to mid 80s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 16 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Monday, September 10th. Stay tuned for our state capitol report coming up between 7 and 8 this morning. Our state government reporter, Sean Johnson, will bring us up to date on state politics, including that crackdown last week on protests at the state capitol. We'll also hear from a guest from the ACLU of Wisconsin about that crackdown and then the easing up of the arrests of people who were carrying signs without a permit. We also will have an update from one of our education columnists at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, who will tell us the issues involved in the Chicago teachers' strike. The Chicago teachers are on strike this morning. We will find out why coming up after 7:30. Right now, we are talking about high blood pressure and a report from the CDC that says blood pressure is out of control for too many Americans. We're talking about the scope of the problem and what we can do about it. And we are welcoming your questions about preventing and treating high blood pressure for our guest, Dr. Patrick Remington, who is a professor and associate dean of public health at UW-Madison. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. So, Dr. Remington, what is the typical treatment if one has high blood pressure?
Well, there are two general types of treatment. You mentioned prevention and also control or treatment. Unfortunately, most healthcare providers these days move immediately to controlling or treating high blood pressure, although there are recommendations for changes in diet and exercise. Losing weight is a wonderful treatment for high blood pressure. It's much easier to prescribe medicine. A physician will first make sure the diagnosis is correct. That requires a couple of measurements on different days. And once your blood pressure level has been documented, then medicine is often prescribed to bring the blood pressure down within normal limits. I should point out that just as CDC released this report last week, in the middle of August, the Cochrane Collaborative, which is a highly regarded independent organization that reviews the literature, it answers the questions, what exactly do we know, reported that treatment for borderline or mild hypertension between 120 and 140 for, 140 and 160 for systolic blood pressure and 90 and 100, which many, many people have, the research is not convincing that that treatment leads to better health outcomes down the road. So that's a very important study that has just come out. People are trying to reassess what it means. It certainly doesn't mean that if you're taking medicine you should stop, but I think the medical community is going to look at what we offer for people whose blood pressure is in that mild hypertension range.
You might be looking at prescribing more diet and exercise than medicine?
Well, I think prescribing, yes, absolutely. The medicine, it turns out, is hard to take. Sometimes people can't afford the cost. Often, about 1 out of 10 people prescribed high blood pressure medicine stop taking it because of complications or problems with side effects. So that medicine is not without its own problems, costs, and complications. And we certainly should be prescribing more exercise and diet. The CDC report was also a major indictment to the current healthcare system. It pointed out that although there are nearly 70 million people with high blood pressure, about half are not under control, and about 26 million people without control of their blood pressure saw a doctor at least twice in the past year. The point being that people are in the healthcare system, they have insurance, some are even taking medicine, but it's still not under control. And the CDC points out that this is a healthcare system that is focused on expensive modern developments for treating disease, and yet the simple diagnosis and treatment of blood pressure is not something that it does very well, even today.
So what can be done about this?
Well, some health plans have done a great job in diagnosing blood pressure and using systems approaches, automated systems that don't just rely on a physician seeing a patient, but rely on an entire team to make sure that people who have been diagnosed with high blood pressure are prescribed the proper medicines and then are tracked appropriately so that they continue to take the medicine. Better yet, that they are aware of the dietary and exercise changes that are needed, and they have systems to promote that, not simply a prescription that says you should exercise and eat better, but referrals to nutritionists, programs in communities where people can not only learn about what's needed, but have support for that. So really investing where you get the best bang for the buck in preventing hypertension or treating it through lifestyle changes as opposed to expensive medicines.
So why is it important that everybody control their high blood pressure?
Well, again, the what we call the downstream or the end consequences of high blood pressure are very significant. 4 times the risk of stroke, which is a very serious disease, seen primarily in the elderly, but people who are young with very high blood pressure can still develop a stroke and often die or are disabled. So all those complications are not only expensive, but they're debilitating for individuals and easily preventable through prevention of high blood pressure or of control. So it's really a quality of life issue for individuals and their families.
Certainly devastating on an individual basis, but in terms of the public health basis, this adds to healthcare costs.
Well, no doubt. There are many other serious diseases, but there aren't many diseases that are so common. With nearly 60 million people, 60 or 70 million people with high blood pressure, the healthcare dollars mount up easily. I think the estimate was $130 billion each year. That's just the direct cost of healthcare for high blood pressure and the problems it causes. So it's not only a serious problem, but because so many people are affected, it becomes an important public health problem.
I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Dr. Patrick Remington, a professor and associate dean of public health at UW-Madison. We're talking about the problem of high blood pressure. And this report from the CDC released last week that says that this is a big problem. Blood pressure is out of control for too many Americans. Nearly half of some 67 million Americans who have high blood pressure are not effectively treating it. We're talking about the scope of this problem, why it's important, and how we can prevent and control high blood pressure. And we're welcoming your input, your stories, your questions. Are you keeping your blood pressure under control? Or are you someone who maybe isn't taking your prescribed medicine because of side effects? We'll talk a little bit more about that as well. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. And Dr. Remington, I do know someone who happens to be a young man. He's in his mid-20s, and he was prescribed medicine for high blood pressure, which I thought was unusual. Is it?
Well, it's certainly not unusual if the blood pressure is quite high. Again, I don't need to get into the details. That's something you should discuss with your physician. But it's absolutely proven that blood pressure over 160, the systolic pressure, or over 100, the diastolic pressure, needs to be treated. The risk of disease and complications at that level are well known, and the experiments or the randomized clinical trials are absolutely sure of the benefit of medicine. This new information about treating mild blood pressure, it seemed to make sense that if you would bring your blood pressure from a mildly high level between 140 and 159 and 90 and 99 down to normal, it seemed to make sense that that would reduce your risk, but evidence is not convincing. And so the medical and research community is just digesting that information literally as we speak to try and understand how you could improve the effectiveness of treating mild hypertension. But it's well known that there's no side effects of exercise and eating right, and so that if we could be more effective in promoting better diets and more physical activity, that comes without complications. It also benefits many other health concerns. So that I think that with this new information, there'll be a shift towards lifestyle interventions, again, to try and do more than simply write that on a prescription pad and feel that the doctor has done his or her job, but to make sure that there are systems in place to help people do what the doctor recommends.
I have to admit, I don't know exactly what his numbers are, but he did stop taking the blood pressure medicine because of the side effects. He found them to be unpleasant. What are the side effects of blood pressure medicine?
Well, there are several important side effects. One of which is if you're not taking the right amount, your blood pressure can become too low. And then it depends on the type of medicine. It can affect your heart rate, your ability to exercise. It also changes your level of potassium sometimes, and you have to have that checked frequently. So there are many different side effects. Depends on the specific type of medicine. And again, we don't really expect patients to understand the array of medicines that are needed. That's really up to the physician and the healthcare team to understand what medicine might work in a first prescription, or if that doesn't work, how you bring in other medicines. So there's one or two or even sometimes three medicines that can be used in concert. But again, as you point out, medicines are not without side effects, and research has shown that as many as 1 in 10 people with significantly elevated blood pressure stop taking it because of the side effects.
But he is trying to work on his diet and exercise, so hopefully that will help him. A listener named Terry wants to know, how much do nicotine and caffeine affect blood pressure?
Well, nicotine and caffeine are stimulants. They raise the blood pressure momentarily, so that it does not raise it over the over a long period of time. But certainly, with caffeine, the research shows in balance that caffeine in coffee and coffee in general seems to have as many benefits as it does side effects. But some people are particularly sensitive to the stimulant in caffeine. They find their pulse increasing, blood pressure increasing slightly, even sometimes arrhythmias, like a extra heartbeat, will occur with caffeine. So it's very individual. Certainly, the major difference between caffeine and nicotine is not the effect on blood pressure, but nicotine is highly addictive and often delivered in a cigarette, which is which kills the patient when used as intended. So that there are a lot more important problems with nicotine than simply the effects, relatively minor effects on blood pressure.
We are talking about blood pressure and the problem of uncontrolled high blood pressure, according to a CDC report released last week. We're talking about why this is such a big problem and what we can do about it, and we're welcoming your thoughts, your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Remington. He's a professor and associate dean of public health at UW-Madison. We'll check news from National Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Radio, and then we'll be back. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Do you have high blood pressure? Do you have any questions about preventing or controlling high blood pressure? I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 6:36 on this Monday, September 10th. We're talking about a new report from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about uncontrolled high blood pressure. It says nearly half of about 67 million Americans with high blood pressure are not effectively treating it. We're talking about the scope of the problem and what can we do about it, and welcoming your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dr. Patrick Remington, a professor and associate dean of public health at UW-Madison. And a listener named John from Green Bay asks, what causes blood pressure differences between the left arm and the right arm? What number is significant enough to warrant taking it to a doctor? Dr. Remington?
Well, that's a good question. Some people just have a different anatomy, so that the size and shape of the arteries varies. Arm size can vary, and the size of the cuff has to be changed depending on the size of the arm. So there are often mild differences, maybe 3 or 5 millimeters of mercury between arms. There are differences even in the time that the blood pressure is taken. For example, the left arm might be right when you come in to see the doctor, and they may retake it on the right arm sometime later. So I wouldn't worry so much about small differences between the arm. The most important thing is the level of the blood pressure over a number of different times and settings. And again, the guide is that 120 over 80, as we said, is sort of the target blood pressure. When you get to the 140 over 90, you're right on the cusp of developing mild hypertension. But 160 over 100, when you hear those numbers, 160 systolic and 100 diastolic, that definitely needs to be treated. There's no doubt about the need to see a physician and get treatment, not just lifestyle, but probably at that point medicine is required.
We have a caller. We have a caller from Hazelcrest, Marty in Hazelcrest. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. And I've had, I guess, what's considered borderline blood pressure for most of my life. The last several years, I just started taking lisinopril for it. And then I was listening to one of your shows over the weekend, and some a couple that are doctors saying that maybe I really ought not to be taking this stuff. I'm in shape. I don't eat a lot of salt. I try to avoid it if I can. What's your thoughts? I'll take my response up here.
Sure, but hold on, Marty, just in case there's a follow-up question.
Sure.
Well, this is quite a significant development in our understanding of blood pressure. This August 15th report coming out of the Cochrane Review, again, it's an international independent organization that does a very precise job of reviewing exactly what we know. And they promote what we call evidence-based medicine. That is not simply doing things because it seems to be the right thing to do, but doing things that have been proven convincingly to lead to more benefit than harms. And so this really turned the medical community upside down, where the evidence is not convincing on the treatment of mild high blood pressure. Again, that's the lower number in the 90s and the higher number, 140 to 159, because of problems with people continuing the medicine and side effects and the fact that maybe simply lowering the number doesn't do as much as we once thought. So I think for patients in that mild hypertension range, since we don't know for sure, I certainly wouldn't just stop taking the medicine. But I think it's worth a conversation with your physician about, as you say, looking to lifestyle interventions, watching not just the sodium that you shake on foods, but that's actually in prepared foods. Exercise is wonderful. It keeps weight under control, and body weight is a major risk factor. And then also, it's been shown that this DASH diet, D-A-S-H, stands for Dietary Approaches to Stop Hypertension, is quite effective. And you can look online, Google DASH diet, and it turns out it's the diet for other healthy purposes, like losing weight. But it's high fruits and vegetables, whole grain foods, slightly less dietary fat, but shifting more to the liquid fats and the good fats. So that focus on diet and exercise, and then talk to your doctor about this issue of what the benefits are of treating mild hypertension.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Marty, for the call. Is this something we should have? We should be monitoring daily at home, Dr. Remington? Take a cuff and monitor our blood pressure?
Well, for most people, that's not required. For most people, when you see a physician or actually any health care provider, oftentimes dentists or pharmacies have blood pressure cuffs available, it is good to at least annually have your blood pressure checked. And for most people, this is sufficient. But there are some people where they might be on the cusp of going from mild to moderate hypertension. And then I think it's important to check the blood pressure more frequently. And there is a subgroup of people with high blood pressure that only occurs when you're in the doctor's office. And so oftentimes physicians will send a blood pressure cuff home or ask them to take it in other settings just to see how the blood pressure varies over time. But in the end, it's really the average of those measures that leads to the diagnosis of whether or not you have high blood pressure that needs treating.
So if your blood pressure is not 120 over 90 or 80, I think you said, the normal blood pressure, but it's more like, let's say it's 100 over 60, should I be worried?
Well, some people say that the lower the better, that risk of stroke and heart disease and kidney disease go down, the lower the blood pressure. For people with blood pressures of 110 over 70 or 100 over 60, if those individuals are not symptomatic, meaning as you get up from the chair or rise from bed in the morning and you're not feeling dizzy, that there's really no evidence that blood pressure that's low naturally can be too low. But again, if you have symptoms of dizziness, then you may have naturally low blood pressure. If that's low because of the medicine that someone is taking, then you should definitely see your physician about perhaps cutting back on the amount of medicine. And certainly if you're symptomatic, and there's a term called orthostatic, meaning that when you your position determines your blood pressure. And so if you have orthostatic hypotension, low blood pressure, then certainly, and especially if it's medicine-related, you should see your physician.
No, not medicine-related and no symptoms. But in fact, my doctors usually say, oh, that's good.
That's correct. That blood pressure, again, the 120 over 80 is sort of the average number that people look for. That's fine, but I know physicians, when they see a blood pressure of 100 over 60, that's causing less stress on the vessels. And high blood pressure can cause stretching of the small vessels and small scars and then lead to damage down the road. So as long as the blood pressure is doing its job, getting blood circulating to your brain and all the vital organs, lower blood pressure is probably better.
Does that mean I can be the salt fiend that I am and pour salt on everything?
Well, I wouldn't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Yeah.
I think, again, the lower blood pressure, the better, but I think moderation in all things, and that some people are more sensitive to the hypertension effects of salt, and so those people respond with much higher blood pressure based on dietary sodium. Other people seem to be relatively immune to the effects of salt.
Yeah, and I don't mean to make light of it because it is a serious issue, but why does sodium affect blood pressure? Do we know?
Well, it's fairly complicated. The kidney spends its day trying to keep enough fluid in the body and the dilution of the salt, the right level for all our cells to operate, and yet still get rid of toxins and too much sodium. So salt can affect the ability of the kidney to do its job. The kidney also releases a hormone that regulates blood pressure, so that sodium can affect the kidney's ability to self-regulate. So, and again, that there's, as with most diseases, there's genetic variability in the effect of sodium on one's blood pressure.
I get it. Harry in Madison is with us. Hello, Harry.
Yes, hi. Could the doctor talk about the importance of hyperlipidemia and high blood pressure, and what is the role of statins in controlling this?
Well, sure. The high blood pressure is only one of a group of what we call cardiovascular or heart risk factors. Hyperlipidemia is too much bad fat in the blood vessels, most likely due to differences in one's diet. People who eat a lot of calories or have lots of saturated fat in their diet have higher levels of lipids, often called cholesterol, the different kinds of good and bad cholesterol. And what we see is a combination of the hyperlipidemia, hypertension, and even hyperglycemia or high glucose. And when you put all those together, high blood lipids, high blood pressure, and high blood glucose, then you develop what's called a metabolic syndrome. And that's really a high risk. Often people say it's a heart attack just waiting to happen. So if you're in the group of patients with high or borderline lipid levels, high blood pressure, maybe a high blood glucose, that absolutely requires treatment. And not just high blood pressure medicine, but medicine perhaps to take the lipids down, and even medicine to control the glucose. Don't forget the benefits of exercise, because exercise and eating better will affect all of those metabolic problems.
What about, Dr. Remington, controlling anger or stress? A lot of people say the political talk on this talk show sometimes, you know, raises their blood pressure, or, you know, people probably, you know, yelling at the football game yesterday or this weekend, you know, they, you know, might have, their blood pressure might have gone up. Is there a relationship?
Yes, the general recommendation is that stress is important. I think we're just so early in our understanding of how to measure stress. There's a difference between, in effect, good stress, being active and engaged and alert, and bad stress, which is often associated with hostility or anger. Some studies have shown that type A personalities are at high risk of heart disease, but then others have shown that it's not the being hyperactive and stimulated, but it's the type of activation, or if it's anger or really agitation. So in general, people recommend, along with other healthy lifestyles, controlling stress, and certainly for many people that would reduce your risk.
So, summing up, Dr. Remington, what's your takeaway on this CDC report on uncontrolled blood pressure?
Well, I think there are two general messages. One is to individuals that high blood pressure is a very important risk factor for disease, and if you don't know your numbers, you should. And if they're higher than they should be, certainly get into your doctor to get advice and perhaps treatment. The second audience is the whole healthcare system. We as healthcare providers, as a healthcare system, need to do a better job of controlling blood pressure. It's really inexcusable that nearly half of all people with high blood pressure are not under control, and that really is something that the healthcare system needs to improve.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor and Associate Dean of Public Health at UW-Madison, talking to us about this CDC report that says blood pressure is out of control for too many Americans. About half of the 67 million Americans with high blood pressure are not effectively controlling it. Checking our weather forecast for today, sunny and mild with highs in the mid to upper 70s. Tonight, clear with lows in the 50s. Another sunny, warm day tomorrow with highs in the low to mid 80s. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. It's time now for our Monday morning wake-up call. And appropriately enough, today's Monday morning wake-up call is on the dangers of driving while drowsy. So wake up. Our guest is with us to talk about the dangers of driving while drowsy and how we can prevent this. She is Jenna Noe, a sleep disorders technologist at the St. Mary's Janesville Hospital Sleep Lab. And she joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
So talk a little bit about the problem of driving while drowsy. It's apparently as bad as driving while drunk, or comparable anyway.
Definitely. The National Sleep Foundation has a statistic when you view their website that indicates that drowsy driving is the cause of 1 in 6 deadly car crashes, and that the equivalent of being awake for 20 hours or more is equivalent to the legal limit for alcohol, so that 0.08% of inebriation.
What are the signs of drowsy driving? I suppose if you're nodding off, that would be a big one.
Definitely. And other signs are like keeping or continuous yawning, unable to keep your eyes open, you know, where you might start to begin to head bob a little bit, or just that time where you feel like you should put the toothpicks in your eyes.
Mm-hmm.
If you kind of space out while you're driving, you suddenly can't remember how you got from point A to point B. We talk about being on autopilot, but that's an indication that we're driving drowsy and we're potentially dangerous when we're on the road. If we begin to tailgate too much, or if we're suddenly making mistakes in our driving, like we're missing turns, or we are not paying attention to the road signs, changing the lanes, like drifting back and forth into traffic, or if we hit the rumble strips on the side of the road.
So what's the difference between driving when you're just maybe a little tired and driving drowsy?
I would say it's the like how extreme your behaviors are. I think most people at some point have gotten behind the wheel when they're feeling a little bit tired. But if you begin to notice that all of a sudden you're really struggling to maintain wakefulness, or you're really not focused, that you're kind of driving distractedly, that's at the point where you've crossed that line into the dangerous point. And they definitely recommend that if you notice that that's happening, going ahead and taking steps like pulling off the road and taking maybe a 10 to 15 minute nap, it makes you safer for yourself, but not only for yourself, for the other people on the road.
So what do you recommend to prevent drowsy driving?
Well, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine has drowsy driving prevention tips on their website, and they recommend things such as getting a full night of sleep. The recommended amount is 7 to 8 hours. To avoid driving late at night, so if you're typically a day person and you're out on the road at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, that's obviously going to make you more tired and probably a less effective driver. Avoid driving long distances alone. Make sure that when you're driving that long distance that you have another passenger so that you have someone that can talk to you and kind of monitor your driving. Pulling over at a rest stop and taking a nap if that's needed. Caffeine is recommended for a short-term boost. The statistics on caffeine and its effectiveness kind of vary. But I remember going to one seminar, and they said that really caffeine only gives us about 10 to 20 minutes of, like, a stimulated effect or waking us up more when we're driving. And then if you're working a night shift or if you're working unusual or even if you feel like you're going to be dangerous, call for a ride, take the bus, do whatever you need to do to make sure that you're not getting behind the wheel.
Yeah, so blasting the radio and opening the window isn't going to help me?
Not necessarily. I looked for the statistics, and I couldn't find it today, but this one seminar I went to, the doctor was talking about it, and they had done a study that indicated how each, like, step that we would take affects our wakefulness while driving, and they estimated that opening the window with the cold air coming in woke us up for less than 5 minutes, that blasting the radio was, like, 1 to 2 minutes, caffeine was maybe up to 20 minutes. It was really interesting, and then they showed a video clip that compared the actual driving abilities of people who were at the legal alcohol limit compared to people who had been awake for 23 hours, and their driving came out to be exactly the same. It was kind of interesting to watch them do the obstacle course and things like that.
Wow. You know, the statistic that if we are awake for 20 hours or more and then get behind the wheel, that's the same as driving drunk. What if you are just someone who you're sleep deprived long term? You're chronically sleep deprived. Do you have this? Is it the same thing?
Yeah, definitely. People who are at greater risk of being sleep deprived and driving drowsy are often young men. They're more likely to have longer periods of wake time. Their sleep schedule isn't as regulated as it could be, and potentially men have more undiagnosed sleep disorders, particularly obstructive sleep apnea. Shift workers are also at greater risk. Other untreated sleep disorders, long-term insomnia can increase your daytime fatigue. And then if you're on medications, which can make you drowsy, any of those things can definitely make you a drowsy driver that's not related to long-term sleep deprivation, or more precisely, over 20 hours.
Yeah. And I suppose contact your local sleep lab if you have an issue with this. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Jenna Noe, a sleep disorders technologist at the St. Mary's Janesville Hospital Sleep Lab. Thanks to Amanda Magnus and to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins and to Cynthia Schuster for producing these programs. Thank you for listening. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.